Session number 106-99.
Brigadier Rymer Jones, Reel 5. What happened next, then, in the Luce area?
Well, by August 1916, I'd fallen in love with trench mortaring, these great heavy toffee apples which could cause such destruction and could be such a menace to oneself also. And so I couldn't keep away. And even when it wasn't my turn, I'd go up to see how the chaps were getting on at night. It was tremendous fun, in spite of the dangers that one obviously had to face. But and in the 3 days off, I enjoyed so much this meeting with old friends at Béthune at the officer's tea shop, and the life in the billets behind.
What did you enjoy about it? What was it that made it so enjoyable?
Well, one heard what was going on in the other parts of the line, and two, there was naturally one moment you're in the front line trench and throwing stuff at each other with the Germans, and the next moment you're in civilization behind, meeting old friends, and the troops, your troops were getting a good rest.
What about the French? What did you think of them in Béthune?
The French, oh, we didn't meet the French then. I didn't meet the French in actual action until Passchendaele.
I mean the civilians.
Civilians liked us very much, because when they had their own troops billeted on them, they didn't get much money, if anything, and the troops were very almost hostile to them. But when our people were in, they were getting very good billeting money from the government, and the troops liked them very much, you know. And I always tell a little story about how when I was out in Les Brebis, and every afternoon down the road past the long gardens of the miners' cottages where the troops on rest were probably helping Madame with the washing and so on, down the road would come this little man, broad, with a very smart uniform cap on, blue blouse, striding down the road, and as he passed, the Tommies would always call out to him, "Allemand bon!" And he, with a voice of thunder, would roar, "Allemand no bloody bon!" And, oh, he's very childish, I know, but it was one of the things that made the life behind so pleasant. And also, it was very close up. The batteries, the one I stayed with at night, was only just in front of our rest place. But the Germans didn't do much because they had provided the money for the mining area for all the cottages.
You said that, yes.
So I said that before, didn't I?
So what happened
well,
next?
Well, but then you rather cut me out. I was going to get straight into it.
Sorry.
Loving this life in there, a very proud of one's men, and loving their life, for example, in the early morning after battling through the night, I'd be passing down the front line trench, and the Tommies who were standing down for a bit then were making tea, and tea then probably in a Dixie. First of all, you've got your boiling water and masses of tea, and then you had masses of sugar and masses of condensed milk, and the thing was quite frightful to the taste, but to me, after the night, it was heaven, and you were always offered a cup by the troops. Marvellous. Well, into this I got a lot of feeling of dissatisfaction because our divisional CRA was Paddy Reid, VC, an extraordinary man who I admired in some ways, but he was inspired in what I call his evil doings by his assistant, who was Tim Pyle, who was to be the head of anti-aircraft in the Second Great War. And I used to call him, and everybody else called him, his evil genius, because he had a habit of dropping in on batteries. And Pyle would say, now, supposing we have a look at officers' servants' dugouts. And having gone in there and found there was, quite improperly, an official post bag or something ridiculous like that, there was a shocking row, and everybody was rushing to the telling the other batteries, it's officers' servants' dugouts today. And on the other hand, he was a great martinet, but he ran a very fine divisional artillery. No getting away from that. He had got his VC by, with two other officers, going out and bringing in an officer's body between the lines with the Boers, and all three were given the DSO. And when it was discovered that it was Lord Robert's son, they were turned into VCs. As I say, these trivialities that they looked for, and on one famous occasion only, the only time they ever came near the front line trenches, they appeared at my battery, or at one of the gun positions. And I was down the front line doing a shoot with one of the others. And they found in one of the gun emplacements the leather case for a sight. And, of course, straight away, Paddy went off the end because it wasn't sufficiently dubbined, according to him. Well, this wasn't mine at all. It was one being left by the old division. But that didn't matter. When I got back to my gun position, they said, the general's been there, and you ought to go straight away to see him. Well, I thought, oh, hell. And it meant going a long way back, and then going down to Le Breby, and then having a horse to take me to Nolimine, where divisional headquarters was. That was about 7 miles away. And then I was paraded there and found that a friend of mine called Hammond, who was in another battery, was also for a flogging. So we stood in front of them with Paddy Reid sitting at his desk and Tim Pyle alongside. And even Tim Pyle got a bit frightened because Paddy Reid, it must have been 2 minutes, he just screamed at us. And then having screamed at us, he said, I know that you're up in front facing danger and so on. I think of you, keeps me awake at night. So I thought, you old devil. And he said, stop and have some food before you go back. This is typical of Paddy. But several cases were people who went to hospital after they'd had a cursing from him. And of course, this was not required at all. And I said to him, what were you there for? He said, well, he went into one of my kind positions, and he spoke to the fellows there, and he said, have you got plenty to read? And the chap said, oh yes, I've got some books and so on. He said, but you'd like more, wouldn't you? He said, don't they give you more books? No, sir. He was only in for 3 days and he was out, you see. And so he was dragged up for this. So I wasn't very friendly to Paddy Reed, although he sent this thing afterwards to me when we had this great success bringing down the tower of the mining tower. And he then sent a thing along of the Zeppelin being brought down in flames and wrote on it, why 40 battery brings down the mining tower. All very trivial, but it rather spoilt mine, you know. We were rather proud of what we were doing, really. However,
there was an accident in one of your last stints in the
line.
Yes,
I'm just coming to that. Another thing which rather soured things was when I got a note from divisional headquarters saying that an officer was being sent up to do a shoot at one of my guns, a flank gun farthest away, with a silencer. Well, as a matter of fact, you could hear a sort of plop when German things were coming over to you and vice versa. But it wasn't important, that at all. So I thought, why the devil can't I do it? But this was a chap being sent up, obviously, from the trench mortar school or from divisional headquarters, who wasn't actually an active man, you see? Well, owing to my success with these shoots, they sent Knight's poor old gunners, who were having a pretty cushy time, were sent up with these 60-pound bombs over their shoulders, staggering away, and they say, when can we join the trench mortars? We don't think this is very funny. And we had 200 of these 60-pound bombs in the new shelters that they'd built for us and dugouts. And each gun, 200, which is quite ridiculous, because they were hoping that we were going to spend all our lives shooting off. Well, our poor infantry, you know, the Germans didn't like it much, and they'd shoot back. And this was supposed to be a quiet thing where you were saving ammunition for the Somme, you see. Well, up this chap came, and I took care, of course, not to interfere with the big boys and so on, and stayed the other end, busy with my other guns. I heard this enormous explosion. And so I walked down along the line that was about in the front line trench to about, I suppose, 300 yards to my other flank gun. There was no gun. There was a hole as big as this room and as deep as this room. And the 200 bombs had gone up. That in terms of explosive was pretty fast. And there was no sign of our two men or of poor old Henry, the officer who was doing the shoot. We found his walking stick a quarter of a mile away, and the inside of a picture of Gladys Cooper, who was the great star actress at the moment. And that was all we found of him at all. So that was very sad, particularly the loss of my men, of course. We wrote to poor old Henry's people, of course.
Would you write to the men, the two men, would you write to their families as well as the officers?
Always, always. That was throughout the army. I mean, you always wrote to the next of kin.
When you were doing a shoot, this is just a technical point, were you in signal contact with the mortars? Would you be at an OP and then you'd have lines back to...
No, you just ran out your wire, you see. You ran out your wire. Not in this... In cases you hear in Passchendaele and so on, it was all a question whether you could keep your lines going and your signallers. Gunner signallers were the most gallant of men. They'd go out under bombs and shells and mend the line, you see.
You had the same system with the trench mortars, though.
Well, it was only a few yards, really, you were dealing with in the way of line.
So that was one of your last tours in the trenches when this accident happened, and you. This was when you went to the Somme. What?
No, I'm sorry, it wasn't. At last I got news that I was going for leave. Well, leave had been very much held up owing to the Somme tragedies and so on, but I had 5 days leave. It's gone up from 3 days to 5 days, and a lot of that time was taken in getting back to England, is it? However, when I'd finished that leave, which I did on the quiet with my parents, and on return, to my surprise, I was not back in the loose salient, but my people had been moved to the Somme. The Somme was in its latter stages by then.
What month would it be?
Because this was in October. And the weather was quite appalling. And the Somme battlefield, which was nothing but mud, and it was in every way appallingly unpleasant. We were put in the trenches, which were almost full of water. The only protection from the Hun mortars and the artillery was down the dugouts. And those dugouts were German built, so they were facing the wrong way, if you see what I mean, so that anything coming over from the enemy was apt to come down your dugout. In addition to that, as soon as you put your nose out of the dugout, there was a sort of flurry of trench mortars from the other side and artillery shells. What one hadn't realized was that the Germans were already preparing to withdraw to the Hindenburg line. Well, nobody could ever imagine that either side would be so stupid from a morale point of view to withdraw. But the Germans were very clever. This was Ludendorff. And they'd made this magnificent line behind, every comfort for their own troops, every difficulty for ours. Although they hadn't gone back, they'd started all this withdrawal business, you see, which we didn't know about. And as the trenches got full of water, we weren't able to function at all. We were withdrawn. And the troops were put on the job of guarding divisional headquarters, which was in the Maurepas Ravine, well back, almost back to Combles, where the first attacks had gone from. And we found that we had nowhere for our own comfort except tents. Now, this Somme winter was the most important thing for morale, because we had to reorganize altogether. Horses were out on the lines the whole time. They were never during the war in stables or anything like that. And with the appalling weather and the lack of horse mastership among a great many of the officers, we were losing horses too in a big way. And when I got back to the war later on. I found that we'd had horse advisors to every gutter brigade, as well as our vet, which of course saved the day, but we were in an appalling position there. Well, now for our own comfort, which naturally had to come second, to be in a tent with snow on the ground and appalling cold was nobody's business. And
how did you try and keep warm? I mean, what could you do?
You couldn't have heating in the tents, you see. So the only thing I could do then was we had a double loo, heavily sandbagged all round in the entrance, you see. It was like little rooms. And although there was no connection between the two, you could talk to the chap next door. So Hammond, from another battery, who came and joined us for a bit then, he and I used to sit in the loo most of the night, because this heavily sandbagged kept it reasonably warm, and talked. And unfortunately, he hadn't got his gramophone to amuse us, because he had collected, in the days when we were on the loose sector, some 300 records. Beautiful. Mostly classical. But on this occasion, he had come back from leave, and I don't know how he fixed up with us, but all he'd got was a small suitcase, a gramophone record of Chrysler's violin, and he demanded that, you know, you had these layers of your sleeping bag. And so he got in one layer of my sleeping bag and I was in another. Well, that didn't mean for any sleep. I'd sort of be in the loo. At any rate, fortunately for me, I think, I was posted to two different field artillery batteries when they were rather short of people, two periods. Second one being Sam Bulteel's battery while he was on leave. And they were called the Galloping Blacks, his very nice battery. And I enjoyed being with them, but because I was there when the last small attack of the Somme offensive took place, when we recaptured a place called Sailly-Sail, and then I was back again, of course, to these terrible conditions behind divisional headquarters. While I was there, in this wide ravine where this all went on, I saw one day there was a trench which I felt had been put there in case there were German attacks and there had to be any retreat. But it was only in the early stages. It was just a shallow, wide trench, just as appeared, if they'd have you believe it, in the It's a Lovely War thing, where pictures were shown of generals talking to the troops, no other officers ever shown. And I thought, what the devil is this doing? And to my surprise, I found troops parading there in battle kit. But not, as the official history said, with full kit and all the rest of it. But they were making a very gallant show of going over the top. Well, it wasn't very difficult to get over the top, just as the pictures are shown in the War Museum magazine they sent me.
It was a similar setup to that of the sequence of going over the top, which was in the Somme film, of which is a picture.
Well, of course, There's some film was really almost entirely a question of going over the top. That was what got people, you know. And, of course, it was very unreal, the whole thing.
What did you actually see then at this? That they actually just went over the top?
They were just... The cameraman was taking shots of them just going over the top, you see. And then he'd stop them and they'd do it again or... I walked over to him and I said, what's going on here? He said, oh, these are the shots of the Second Battle of the Somme. Well, he was quite wrong, of course, because it was a Somme offensive. It had gone on from July the 1st until... That must have been when I was there, about February, I suppose.
This would be round into 1917, about February,
yes,
you saw this happen.
Yes, yes.
What was he directing, when the troops were making these fake attacks, was he telling them what to do, or was there an officer?
Well, I suppose I wasn't so interested in all that. I merely thought, what are these comics doing, you see?
Was there any sort of fake explosions or
artillery? Oh, no.
Just them jumping out, yes, in the shallow.
Well,
trench.
There wouldn't have been going over the top, you see. Not till they had started to move over, then the German machine guns, before they could get over to the German lines and the wire, the barrage would have lifted and gone on, you see, and the German machine gunners would have come out and did come out then with the machine guns before our fellas got over.
In this fake, were there any people pretending to be casualties or anything like that?
No.
So it was just them jumping out of the train?
I don't know what they were doing. I mean, I'm talking about a matter of minutes. They were probably carrying on for a long time.
And there was just one cameraman, was there, that you saw?
Yes, that's all.
And he had a movie camera machine.
Yeah.
What, do you remember, was it on a tripod or anything? Did you notice?
Well, I think so, I don't know. I wasn't interested, I mean, I wasn't taking part in the show. I really thought it was a good joke.